Welcome to State of the Bay. This is Grace Wan. Every Monday night, we're live and local with news, conversation, and culture from this place we call home. Tonight, we're sitting down with Oaklandside education equity reporter Ashley McBride to get an update on the Oakland Unified School District. Students head back to school next week. Then we'll take a look at the cannabis industry and examine whether increased availability, potency, and social acceptance has led to a new and unexpected set of risks for users. And finally, I get to sit down with the author and illustrator of a beautiful new book about San Francisco's iconic Ocean Beach. That's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Later this hour, we'll take a look at the cannabis industry. Since recreational marijuana was legalized in California in 2016, there's been growing concerns about its safety. We'll hear from a young woman who's experienced marijuana addiction firsthand, as well as local doctors who are seeing and studying the potential risks. Then, are you a fan of Ocean Beach? I mean, who isn't? If so, you'll want to hear my interview with Eddie Rubin and Greg Wright. They collaborated on a beautiful new book that brings the beach to life through vivid storytelling and evocative illustrations. But first, Oakland Public School students head back to class on August 11th. That's next week. The district has faced major challenges in recent years, from prolonged financial oversight to contentious decisions about school closures and program cuts. So here to give us an update on how the district is doing and what families can expect as the new school year begins, I'm happy to be joined by Ashley McBride. She's the education equity reporter for the Oakland side. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Ashley.
Hi, thanks for having me, Grace.
Yeah, well, it has been just about a month since the Oakland Unified School District officially exited state receivership, which it was in for 22 years. Can you give us a little bit of background, like what led the state to take over in the first place, and why did it take Oakland so long to get back control?
Right, yes. So in July, the district left state receivership, and as you said, that means for the first time in more than 20 years, the board is free to make decisions completely independently. And back in 2003, the state intervened and gave Oakland a $100 million loan because the district was facing a deficit. And so over the last 22 years, OUSD has been paying back that loan and slowly getting more financial independence back. In 2009, the district, and from 2003 to 2009, the district had a state administrator, so the board was not in control. And then in 2009, they got back a little bit of that control, but from then until this year, they were still paying off that $100 million loan, which they made the final payment on this year, and now they are completely free of oversight. And so what that means is that there is no state or county trustee or someone looking over the board's shoulder to make sure that all of their decisions will keep the district solvent. The board is completely on their own now.
Mm-hmm. And as you've reported, just the very fact of leaving receivership doesn't mean that the district's financial troubles are necessarily over. The board passed its budget this summer, and you say that the districts could still be on the road to insolvency. Why is that?
Well, they still have an ongoing structural deficit. So that means they continuously spend more money than they bring in. And there's a number of reasons for that. They passed a budget in June. And while they were able to balance it, they were only able to save a 2.9% reserve. And while the state requires a 2% reserve, the district has its own policy of 3%. So they were just under that reserve, that amount that they set for themselves. So that means that if there's any kind of major changes, if like the federal government, you know, tries to claw back funding, the district won't have that big of a cushion to keep them from becoming insolvent. So going into this year, they will still need to make or start having some conversations about making some, you know, fundamental restructuring of the district to get to a sustainable place.
Well, it seems like leadership, particularly at this moment, is important. At the end of the last school year, the superintendent, Dr. Kyla Johnson-Trammell, she parted ways with the district, and she'd been there for about 8 years. When she was supposed to, the hope was that she'd stay for 2 more years. What led to her early departure, and what do we know about the new interim superintendent, Denise Sadler?
Yeah, it was pretty abrupt. As you mentioned, they had just signed a new contract with Superintendent Johnson-Trammell last August. That was a 3-year contract, and she would have stayed through 2026 or 27. I can't remember the exact year yet. But yeah, she was supposed to stay longer than this. And it seems like she and the board just really disagreed on how to further streamline the budget. Mm-hmm. At the last press conference that she gave, Superintendent Kyla Johnson-Trammell talked about not being aligned on what it takes to get to financial sustainability. She was possibly alluding to school closures. She had spoken frequently about what she saw as the need to close schools. I think she saw them as kind of inevitable when you look at the district's finances, enrollment, and the number of schools it operates. And a majority on the board don't believe or don't agree with closing schools. So as Superintendent Johnson-Trammell said during that press conference, they weren't on the same page. So it's time to respectfully part ways. The new superintendent is Denise Sadler. She's a former OUSD principal. She's also been an administrator in other school districts. She was president of OEA, the teachers union, in the 80s and 90s. And more recently, she has taken on principalships at different OUSD schools, like after a principal steps down and the school is hunting for a new one. So that's kind of what she's doing in her capacity as interim soup. She's kind of just ensuring that there's stable leadership while the board engages on a search for a new permanent superintendent.
I mean, these are such tricky times for people in those roles because, you know, the money, there's not enough money there, and school closure seems to be the way to kind of save money. But my goodness, that is a political football that I don't think any board member wants to handle. Is that what the board is saying, that they just don't want school closures?
I mean, that seems to be what they've been saying for the last few times that school closures have been on the agenda. They haven't really gone anywhere. Last December, there was a proposal to merge 10 schools that share campus into 5 schools, and that didn't go anywhere. Back in 2022, there was a grander plan to close schools. They closed 2 that year. And then the following year, there were 5 more on the list to be closed, but there was an election in between. And so the next board came in and reversed that and put that aside. So while it's a perennial topic, and I do think it'll come up again, it remains to be seen how the board might approach things differently this way.
Is the district itself seeing a decline in enrollment? So like when they're closing these schools, is it in part because they don't have enough kids to operate them?
Yeah, like a lot of schools and school districts in California, enrollment in Oakland Unified has been on a downward trend. Charter schools in Oakland are also seeing similar patterns. And because of the way schools are funded in California, that means less funding over time because districts are funded based on average attendance numbers. So even if you maintain a high attendance rate, if there are fewer and fewer kids showing up year after year, that means less money from one year to the next. And increasing attendance in OUSD has been a focus pretty recently because it is a way to increase revenue. I just saw that they're doing a promotion with the Oakland Roots that if you show up to school every day during the first 2 weeks, you'll get a free ticket to a Roots game.
I mean, do what you can, right, to get kids to go to school. another aspect of the tricky politics, not in just Oakland, but any kind of at any school board level, are community organizations, organizers, the parents' associations. And in Oakland, you've reported that several community organizations sent an open letter raising concerns about the board, particularly how they handled Johnson-Trammell's exit. Does the board have the support of the community, or are we going to be looking at recalls too?
Recall is a word that I've heard thrown around. I don't know how far it will get. I do think there are parents in these community groups that you referenced, Oakland and NAACP and Families in Action a few months ago, really are calling for the board to be more transparent in its actions, especially following the superintendent's exit, where there wasn't really a lot of clarity around why that happened, why it was happening then, or what you know, this superintendent who seemed to be getting the district on the right track, why it was time for her to leave. These groups have also brought up agreements with the teachers' union, whom they feel has disproportionate influence over a majority of the school board. There are a majority of the school board members who are endorsed by the OEA teachers' union. And so some of these groups are just saying, asking for leadership to clarify, you know, where they're getting, what's motivating them to make these decisions, and do they have students' best interests at heart? And if they do, could they just please explain that and explain how their actions are going to lead to better outcomes for Oakland youth, because that's what they're there for.
And do we think that, I mean, they're going to be launching this new search for a new superintendent. Will Denise Sadler be a candidate? Has she indicated that she'd like to have the permanent job?
I haven't been able to speak with her yet. So we don't know.
We'll have to wait and see. Well, I wanted to shift a little bit to some investigative reporting that you've done about the school district, and that's the two-part investigative series that you did on the lead contamination in Oakland schools. It's not a new issue because the OUSD officials became aware of the lead in 2017, but can you tell us, where does that stand now? I mean, are the schools cleaned up, and is there money to clean them up?
Yeah, so our investigation, thank you for bringing this up, that I and my colleague Callie Rhodes completed for the Oakland side, really took a look at how the communication around the lead issue broke down last year. So it was revealed that a number of schools had lead in the water. And at the time, and still today, OUSD had a policy that anytime lead was detected above 5 parts per billion, it had to be remediated and the district had to inform families within a day. And they failed at that last part, the communication. And our investigation really looked at the extent to which communication was lacking. School principals were out of the loop. In some cases, schools were tested in April or May, but principals didn't find out until August, days before school was set to start again. And so that was really scary for them, thinking that students or staff could have been drinking from these contaminated water sources for months. What we also looked at in part two was really how the remediation is going. And this summer, the district has spent the summer testing every drinking water source at every school site so that they can analyze those results and figure out really where the lead is coming from, whether it's the pipes, whether it's the fixtures, whether it's the lead soldering, because most Oakland schools are pretty old and were constructed before we had laws in place about what kinds of materials you could use for piping. And so what the expectation is that this year they will be able to identify like what exactly needs to be replaced and figure out how to pay for it. The board did set aside some money from some of the facilities bonds that have been passed that are going to pay for the remediation.
And is there, you know, going back to the communication issue that you had uncovered and kind of seized upon, are there communications to families about how children, faculty, visitors should handle using water at the schools?
Yeah, so one part of their remediation plan was placing these filtered drinking water machines in every school. So you might see them in like airports, things where you can like fill up your water bottle. So those are in every school, at least one. And so they're really directing students to use these filtered drinking water stations because they know that those do not have lead while they test the other fixtures. And as they're testing, they're taking the water fountains like offline and out of service so no one uses them until it's determined that they are safe to use.
Well, it's a lot of great reporting in that series, and I recommend it to everybody. And we're just going to have to leave it there. Ashley McBride is the education equity reporter from the Oakland side. Thanks so much for joining us, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
And everyone out there, read the Oakland side. It is a fantastic resource. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we're exploring growing concerns around cannabis use. Stay with us.
KALW has a long history of sharing fun, meaningful stories about the Bay Area. We're starting a digital community to connect with people that love this place as much as we do. What keeps you here or keeps you coming back? Join KALW's new community on Discord to share what you think makes it special. Visit kalw.org/discord.
Welcome back to State at the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Since California legalized recreational cannabis in 2016, it's become a common fixture across the Bay Area. It was probably pretty common before that even, let's be honest. But driving its popularity is increased availability and social acceptance, as well as a marketing push that depicts cannabis as a safe, natural wellness product. But new studies are emerging, and emergency rooms themselves are reporting the rise of cannabis-related complications, and that's a more troubling picture. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the health risks of cannabis, risks that are often left out of the public conversation. Joining us is Dr. Lynn Silver, who serves as a senior advisor at the Public Health Institute, and she's a clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco. Welcome to State of the Bay, Dr. Silver.
Thank you, Grace.
We're also joined by Dr. Christopher Caldwell. He's chief of emergency medicine at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital and professor and vice chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at UCSF School of Medicine. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Caldwell.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And finally, I want to welcome Nevada resident Alexandra Talbot. She has struggled with marijuana addiction, and she is here to share her story. We are so glad to have you with us, Alexandra.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here as well.
Yeah. And before we begin, listeners, we want to hear from you. Has cannabis affected your health for better or worse, or the health of someone close to you? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on social media. Alexandra, I wanted to start with you. First of all, thank you again for being here and sharing your story. Tell us how cannabis became a part of your daily life when you first started out using it.
Thank you. Well, my first time smoking marijuana was when I was, I think, around 13 years old. I didn't start smoking marijuana consistently until I went into high school. But 13 years old was the starting point.
And, you know, for you, when did it start to feel like, okay, smoking pot is actually a negative thing for me, that this does not feel good?
Well, it wasn't until high school, I guess, like, a year and a half into smoking marijuana consistently, that it started making my relationships with my parents very toxic. I didn't go to school. It was affecting my mental health. I would say a year and a half into smoking marijuana every day, it really started to affect me. It's such a blur. Completely distorts your perspective and reality to the point where I almost don't remember much from when I was smoking marijuana, which is very scary since it affects everyone differently.
And I just had a curiosity, Alexandra, where were you getting your marijuana?
Well, when I was in high school, we would get it from older folks who would sell the marijuana to younger people. Often there would be dealers that were adults actually selling this marijuana to these teenagers who honestly didn't know what they were getting themselves into. I like to say you don't know until you know, because it's a whole change of perspective when you start smoking this marijuana. And it, in my opinion, it is a gateway drug.
Well, you know, Dr. Caldwell, I wanted to turn to you because, you know, when marijuana was legalized in California, a lot of the arguments in favor of legalizing it is it's a mild drug, it's not addictive, and, you know, people were using it. You could get a medical marijuana license to be able to take it. And yet, you work in one of the busiest ERs in San Francisco. Are you seeing more patients with cannabis-related health problems?
So we are certainly seeing more patients with cannabis-related issues across the board. Now, some of that has to do, and some of it is a good thing, people are more willing since legalization to talk about it. They're more willing to admit when they're using and how it might be a factor in why they are presenting. And there's no question that emergency department visits, which is my perspective, I'm certain that it happens in other areas in medicine as well, but emergency department visits have gone up since legalization. And part of that is related to complications related to cannabis use. Part of it is related to decisions that we make when using cannabis. We heard earlier, just right now, that sometimes people don't even remember what they do when they are using cannabis. And that's certainly something that we will see as well.
And, you know, when you say you're talking about these problems, there's the ancillary problems of you're on your, you know, you're high and you make bad decisions, accidents or whatnot. But what about the actual, are people, can they overdose on cannabis or marijuana? Are you seeing those kinds of problems in your emergency room?
Yeah, no, you can certainly see that as well. It's much less common with people that smoke than with the edibles. But since legalization, there has been even more willingness to try a variety of different manners of doing this. And you can absolutely, and I shouldn't imply that you can't do it with smoking, but we see it more commonly with the edibles, where you'll get very, very high concentration products that give you high levels of marijuana. And what we saw in Denver when it was first legalized there, and we certainly saw it in California as well, is people coming in with what we would say higher levels, or even some would say toxic levels of marijuana, and really feeling awful and needing some medical treatment during that time.
Mm. Well, Dr. Lynn Silver, you're a senior advisor at the Public Health Institute, a clinical professor at UCSF, and you've described the cannabis industry as the next big tobacco. Why do you think we're underestimating the risk?
Thank you. Great question. Cannabis is being marketed as if it's the best thing since sliced bread and a wellness product, when in reality, what the industry is selling is nothing like the original plant. The flower is about 5 to 10 times stronger. They're selling chemical derivatives like vapes and dabs that can be 20 times stronger. The state is allowing 2-ounce shots of like pineapple flavored drinks like Uncle Arnie's that have 100 milligrams of THC in them, which is a dose that would knock most of us out. The tobacco industry used to sell cigarettes as an asthma treatment and claim that smoking would help even long after we began to understand its harm. So really, the cannabis industry is doing the same thing. Why there are some very specific situations like cancer chemotherapy where cannabis can be helpful. Mm-hmm. Most of their claims are grossly exaggerated or just plain false, like curing cancer or curing severe depression. And that combination of misleading marketing with more addictive products and of trying to deny or obscure the clear and growing evidence of harms is straight from the tobacco industry's playbook.
Well,
tobacco industry.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but you make such a good point because when we talk about marijuana, it depends on like which marijuana are you talking about, right? And you've listed so many different products that fall under cannabis use, and yet maybe we're not invented at the time legalization came into place. And certainly they seem to be appealing to an audience that kind of wants a potency that perhaps lawmakers weren't thinking about, Dr. Silver.
That's correct. The industry is targeting a lot of its marketing to people who are addicted and very heavy users. But many people, especially people who are naive users, can get into even greater trouble. But people who are already dependent also get into trouble. They're much more likely to develop psychosis, for example, with frequent use. Mm. So we have not done a good job of saying what this new market should look like, of making sure that it's safer, not safe absolutely, but much safer. Essentially, the state has licensed for-profit businesses, but it's placed very, very few restrictions on the types of products they can sell. And those products have just gotten increasingly outrageous and potentially harmful.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. And I'm your host, Grace Wan. Tonight, we're discussing potential risks of cannabis use with Dr. Lynn Silver. She's the senior advisor at the Public Health Institute and a clinical professor at UCSF. We've also got Dr. Christopher Caldwell, chief of emergency medicine at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. He's also the professor and vice chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at UCSF. And we've got Nevada resident Alexandra Talbot, who's sharing her story about her marijuana use and addiction. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Has cannabis affected your health or the health of someone close to you for better or worse? Are you a parent concerned about how normalized cannabis use has become, or a user who's experienced unexpected side effects? Give us a call now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media, or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Alexandra, you've been very open about how hard it was to quit smoking pot. But before we talk about how you quit, was smoking the primary way that you ingested marijuana, or did you try edibles or some of the other products that Dr. Silver mentioned?
Yes, I would try edibles as well as smoking marijuana. And also dabbing like a dab pen. It's very popular nowadays. It's much stronger, I think, than the actual like flower, I guess that's what they say. It's a concentrate, so it's much stronger, and it's a lot. I mean, yeah, it's unfortunate.
For people who don't know what it is, describe what a dab pen is.
Well, it's the wax of the, so it's a concentrate of the marijuana. It's like a wax. It's the concentrate, and then you basically heat up like a rig, let's say, or like a rig. It's very, it's kind of hard to explain, but you heat it up, you melt the wax, and then you inhale it. You're heating the wax, and it's a concentrate, and it's much stronger. So you inhale it, and it's supposed to give you a better high. So you get more high off of that. And for people who have a higher tolerance, they tend to do that more, because if your tolerance builds up over a time, so then you want to get higher and higher and higher, which can be dangerous and very derealizationing to reality, because you kind of get dissociate, you get taken out of this reality that you're in.
So for you, Alexandra, I mean, was quitting marijuana a multi-step process? What did it require? Weeks, months, years? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So it took, I mean, to fully sober up, I went to a rehabilitation facility where I was basically locked down. I couldn't smoke any marijuana. And it took me about 3 years, yeah, actually, to fully get, well, I was sober for like for 3 years, and then I actually did relapse on my 21st birthday, and I would get into that more later. But yeah, it took me 3 years to fully sober up. And then on my 21st birthday, there was a delivery. They do deliveries nowadays for marijuana. So I got kind of curious about that and decided to try it once again and see if there was a better outcome. And that led me to have a psychotic I had psychosis due to that, and it was very easy. It was very easy access. I mean, you just show them your ID, they deliver it to your door, and it's very high potency. I mean, this potency that I had was 93%. I mean, that's insane. That's much higher than how it used to be back then. And it keeps getting higher, so.
Amazing. Dr. Caldwell, I mean, are emergency rooms and doctors now kind of coming to this realization that, okay, we're seeing people with cannabis dependence, and how have protocols changed in the ER?
Yeah, so certainly we are seeing plenty of that, both from the acute, the sudden impacts of intake, and also the long-term impacts as well. And one of the more common things that we will see related specifically to marijuana use is what we call hyperemesis syndrome. And it almost always occurs. You can get in with very high levels, you can get nausea and vomiting. Hyperemesis is a cyclic vomiting that happens usually from long-term marijuana use and can sometimes be relieved by hot water. And so people will sit in the steam of a hot shower for long periods of time, almost, I mean, many times to the point of running out of hot water, and then come to the emergency department. And these can be sometimes very difficult to treat. And they're just one of many things that we see from chronic marijuana use, in addition to those that are coming in for the acute episodes. We've talked about psychosis a few times, and decisions that we make, actions that we take when episodes like that occur, often can land you in the emergency department, or certainly can.
Well, listener Marin writes, thank you so much for covering this topic. I'm the parent of a teenage son who has been in rehab for over 9 months and had his life derailed by cannabis-induced psychosis, which is what we were just talking about. My attitude has changed dramatically from what it used to be. Cannabis is ruining people's lives and tearing apart families. These stories need to be told so that people can understand the risks. I mean, Dr. Silver, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but traditionally there's been this idea that, oh, well, actually marijuana isn't addictive, so it's fine. It's very mild. Is it more addictive because of the potency of the drugs that we're seeing, and also the vehicles by which the drug is being delivered?
Yes, so marijuana has always been addictive, but it was not as addictive as it is today. The percentage of people who use it, who develop addiction, has basically doubled over the last 20 years. So it used to be about 1 in 10. It's probably closer to 1 in 20 now. And if you start as a teenager, it can be as much as 4 in 10. And that is probably due to this tremendous, insane increase in potency. We recently had a high potency task force for the state of California with a group of scientists convened by the state. They made 20 recommendations to the state on how to address the crisis and the harm being caused by these high potency products, and none of them has been implemented to date.
So interesting. We have another comment from a listener. I'm 68 years old and used cannabis nightly for about 8 years to help me sleep. It made falling and staying asleep easy, although it did produce a bit of paranoia before I actually fell asleep. Over time, I became concerned about my decreased REM sleep and its effects on my heart, memory, and cognition. About 3 months ago, I decided to stop cold and try cognitive behavioral therapy for sleep. It was challenging, but I'm happy to say that today I sleep through the night without any worries associated with the frequent use of cannabis. You know, Dr. Caldwell, a lot of people do use gummies. I mean, I'm aware of people who use it to just go to sleep and stay asleep. Is there a, on the spectrum of cannabis use, I mean, we're talking about some really terrible outcomes, but is there, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, a kind of use that can fit into your lifestyle that maybe you might not say is healthy, but is not detrimental to your health?
So we do hear quite a bit in patients that will come in that, oh, by the way, in addition to what I'm coming to the emergency department for, I do use marijuana regularly. And oftentimes they will say for things like sleep or other chronic related issues. And there are some people that absolutely feel better when they are doing that. Now, we don't always know what that looks like long term, and we're starting to see much more of that potential impact as well. But we will see in the emergency department, particularly, which is my perspective, we will see the acute, the immediate issues of taking either very high potency products or developing things like hyperemesis syndrome. And then we will see patients for other things who say, by the way, I am also taking marijuana regularly. And it is often, as you say, as has been described, as something for sleep or anxiety or nausea or things like that.
Well, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your host, Grace Wan, and we're talking about the potential risks of cannabis use. We've got a medical panel and also a recovering cannabis user. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Jen in San Francisco writes, personally, I've tried all forms. I find that gummies and vape pens have much more impact on my reflexes and brain fog hours after I'm no longer stoned. Smoking flower goes right to my brain, and I need to consume less THC overall to get the effect I need, which is for pain management. I've spoken with many others who feel the same way. Hey, Dr. Silver, I wanted to go back to this idea that cannabis is being marketed as a wellness drug or, you know, supplement that you can use. And there's so much out there in the wellness industry that we know a lot about or we don't know enough about. Is there, in your mind, any place in which cannabis is a wellness supplement or drug?
Well, first, let me say in response to your previous question, you know, a lot of people smoke tobacco and didn't die of lung disease, but using it greatly increased the risk of developing lung cancer. So not everybody gets sick from something, but the impact for our population can still be devastating. So we have many individual people who say, oh, I used it, it helped me, I didn't suffer any problems. And that's true. And some people, you know, lots of people get high at a party and don't have any problems. And it's just hard to predict who the person is who's going to develop problems. But it's not a small number of people. And as the product has gotten more potent, it's that number of people who develop problems has grown, and not insignificant problems, because a problem like psychosis or not just transient psychosis, but long-term psychosis triggered by cannabis, is one of the most devastating things that can happen to a person, as one of the listeners testified to earlier. So, yes, you have some people whose pain is helped by cannabis. You have people who are getting chemotherapy for cancer, where cannabis can definitely help. Some people with multiple sclerosis. But cannabis does not prevent or cure cancer. It may, cannabis is not going to probably resolve your mental health issues, and it will most likely make them worse. Cannabis is associated with twice the risk of cardiovascular death, higher risk of stroke and heart attacks. And many older individuals, people my age, are using cannabis for pain or for sleep, and they may have heart disease risk factors, and they have no idea that this is very similar to smoking tobacco, that it can increase their risk of heart attacks. I have a friend of mine who uses it medically, and who I wasn't aware of that, recently had a stroke, and I went over to their house and saw the, cannabis. I said, are you using this? This may be increasing your risk. And they were very upset to hear
Oh, I can imagine.
because for them it was a wellness product that
Yes,
had those kind
yes.
of risks. They, you
Yeah.
know, and many of our older folks are simply not aware. So it does it help some people? Probably, but many other people are also being harmed and may not be aware of it.
Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Jack joining us. Jack, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hello.
Hi, Jack.
Hi. Yeah, I don't know what I'd do without it. I love it. I worked hospice for 30 years, and it helped my depression, because that's a very sad job, hospice. And it made me feel good, and I understood people. I don't know. It's just, I wouldn't know what to do without it. I really do.
Yeah.
Really don't know what
What,
I'd do without it.
Jack, I'm so curious. Like, do you feel that over the time that you've been using marijuana, that it's become more potent, or are you very careful about what you,
Oh,
how
I
you
want
adjust it?
potent. I
You
like
want
potent,
potent.
but it is. Yeah, it's changed. Yeah, it's got more organized. I always said someday I'm gonna be able to buy it off a shelf. I remember saying that as like a 16-year-old, and now I do. I reach up and I think that all the time. There it is. And I don't know. I have a really happy life, and my kids are normal. No one's got extra limbs,
Yeah.
and I don't know. I don't know what I'd do without it. I'd probably be a very unhappy person without it. And
Well,
anyway, I'm glad I live in California. Thanks for letting me say my piece, and
yeah, no one, thank
I
you
feel
for.
really good.
Yeah, it's, I mean, thank you for your perspective on that. I mean, Dr. Silver, there are just a lot of people out there who have Jack's perspective on what marijuana does for their lives. And as you said, tobacco doesn't make everybody sick. Tobacco doesn't cause everybody to have lung cancer. It's fine for some people and less fine for others. It strikes me that, to actually share about the risks of cannabis, that might be a little bit of an uphill battle for the people who use it regularly.
That's absolutely true. And, it was for smokers too. It took a long time. My father was a smoker. He died at 47 from a heart attack. But, it took half of the, US men used to smoke, and took a long time for them to believe that the risks were significant. And it probably will take a long time to change perceptions around cannabis. With legalization came the idea, oh, it's legal, it must be safe. But what we're seeing in the emergency rooms, what doctors are seeing, what families are seeing, shows that it's not as safe of that as it should or could be. It'll never be completely safe, but even the forms of cannabis that have some medical evidence are very low dose. It's, flower. That's well below 10%, which is difficult to find in the California market. Traditional flower was about 3 to 5% THC. The stuff they're selling in the dispensaries now is 25, 30%. So we need to, first, one thing that would help a lot would be bringing our market back to a more reasonable place with lower risks.
Lower risk. I mean, Alexandra, on this idea of people's, you know, perceptions of marijuana and the fact that, as Dr. Silver said, well, if they legalized it, it must be safe. Is that something, you know, as part of your generation, that there's sort of a, it would be difficult to convince younger people that there's a safety issue with marijuana?
Yes, I actually very much think that just because it's legal, people, I like to look at it as an excuse, kind of. Mm-hmm. Sorry, don't hate me for that. But I think people use that term like, oh, since it's legal, it's safe. But actually, it affects everyone differently. How it affects you may affect me completely differently. So it may not, you know, it's weird to explain, but I also was thinking that, is it possible to be like a high, I had a question, sorry, but I was wondering, sorry, I'm a little nervous right now, forgive
no,
me.
No, you're doing great.
So I was also thinking that, is it possible to be a high functioning addict? Because a lot of times I think if you can't live without the substance, then aren't you addicted? I mean, that is an addiction. So I personally think if you can't live without it, then you are addicted and you're just not realizing it. Mm. And my point across is, do we really need this in our society? If we took it away today, how would people respond to that? That's my question. Mm. And is it possible to be a high-functioning addict? Because I think there are low people who don't do well with drugs, and there are people who do well with drugs, but that doesn't mean that they're not addicted.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. Dr. Silver, I know you wanted to highlight the fact that the excise tax on cannabis is supposed to go up on July 1st, but that has been shelved. I understand there's a push to try to delay that. Why is that an important thing for us to know?
Well, when we legalized cannabis in 2016, part of the promise was first of all, very important, we don't want to put people in jail for cannabis, but we mm-hmm. don't want to be landing them in the hospital either. But part of the promise was that this product would be sold legally, it would be taxed, and that tax revenue would go to kids and to preventing addiction and substance use, hundreds of millions of dollars, as well as to supporting environmental remediation of the harms from cannabis grows. And that was happening. In 2025, the industry got the cannabis cultivation tax to be eliminated, and we had children's organizations from around the state negotiated with the governor, and they agreed to compensate the amount that was lost this year by adjusting the excise tax. That happened July 1st, but the industry has been on the war path for the past 6 months, lobbying just like the tobacco industry used to do, making campaign donations, mm-hmm. trying to influence our legislators, and they are succeeding so far. We are facing basically $1 billion boondoggle over the next decade. We're $1 billion that are currently going to fund childcare slots for the poorest kids,
yeah.
substance abuse prevention programs to help kids like Alexandra was when she was younger, and fixing the environmental harms from cannabis. $1.35 billion will be cut from that, yep. By two bills, AB 8 and AB 564, if the legislature does not block these, and that'll just be given as a cash handout, essentially, to the cannabis industry. Mm. It will not solve the problem of the illicit market.
Yeah, well, there's so much more here to discuss, and certainly this was an eye-opening conversation, but I'm afraid that's all we have for tonight. That was Dr. Lynn Silver. She's a senior advisor at the Public Health Institute and a clinical professor at UCSF. We also heard from Dr. Christopher Caldwell, chief of emergency medicine at San Francisco General, and Alexandra Talbot, who shared her experience with cannabis addiction. Thanks to all of you for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it. Coming up after this break, we'll hear about the iconic Ocean Beach. Stay tuned.
Never miss a beat with the KALW app. Stream your favorite music programs on your schedule anytime, anywhere. Whether you're at home or on the go, the music you love is just a tap away. Download the KALW app now and stay connected to the sounds of the Bay Area.
so gone, thinking for so long that I would find my peace of mind. Yeah, hey, drifting thoughts in the swelling moments that make my madness multiply.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. This is Grace Warren. If you've ever walked along Ocean Beach and wondered about the birds overhead, the crabs underfoot, or the surfers in the waves, this next segment is for you. Longtime Ocean Beach regulars Eddie Rubin and Greg Wright have collaborated on a beautiful new book that brings the beach to life through vivid storytelling and evocative illustrations. It's called Ocean Beach, Fog, Fauna, and Flora, and it's both a guide and a love letter to one of San Francisco's most iconic stretches of coast. Eddie's the author, and Greg is the illustrator. Welcome to State of the Bay, Eddie and Greg.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Eddie, you say in the introduction to the book that this is your love letter to Ocean Beach. Tell us a little bit about what inspires you about that stretch of coastline and why you decided to write the book.
Well, I first met Ocean Beach about 40 years ago, and I was visiting places to do science. And I went to the top of the UCSF Parnassus research building, and in one direction I could see the bay and the skyscrapers and the bridges. The other direction, I was astounded by giant waves crashing against the Marin headlands and the lines of swell disappearing on the horizon, but eventually hitting Ocean Beach. And so it was sort of a love at first sight. And since that time, I've kind of been a regular.
Yeah, I mean, are you a lifelong surfer or a lifelong beach person?
Yeah, I'm a lifelong surfer. And there are some charms of Ocean Beach that make it a really special place.
And what are those?
Well, it's a primal place. It's not a very hospitable. There are big waves. It's challenging to get out. As a result, there aren't big crowds. There's a lot of sea life, too. You're in the lineup, and you see seals and dolphins. It's part of the flyway of birds along Pacific, and so you'll see tons of birds. And so there's a lot going on in addition to riding waves.
Greg, tell me a little bit about your relationship to Ocean Beach.
Yeah, I live in the Richmond District and try to get out there at least a couple times a week to surf. I have been living in San Francisco all my adult life, and the beach has been a big part of that.
And how did it come that you two became collaborators, Greg?
Eddie and I, or Eddie's known me since before I was born. Him and my parents are friends. And we were on a surf trip together, and he had asked everybody on the trip to give a brief talk. And for his talk, he shared some of the writing he had started to do on this book. And then for my talk, I shared some of the art I'd done over the years. And then we got this idea to have me illustrate the book, and we worked on it collaboratively. As he wrote it, I would illustrate it, and here we are.
Well, Eddie, I mean, as we talk about the book, it has something about flora, the fauna, and also the fog that Ocean Beach is famous for. Tell me a little bit about some of the flora that you find, you know, particularly evocative of Ocean Beach.
I don't view the flora as so evocative of Ocean Beach. It's really the fauna that I think is the most evocative.
Yeah, and what about the fauna do you love?
Well, you know, my favorite is, you know, I love them all. I love the Dungeness crabs. I'm a forager, and so I'm a crabber from the shore. And Greg mentioned my story about crabs, and so I'll tell you. It's one day when I was walking in after a surf, I looked down and I saw what looked like a crab buried under the sand. And I love crab, Dungeness crab meat.
Who doesn't love Dungeness crab? I mean, it's the superior crab.
It is. It is sweet, fresh Dungeness crab meat. And so, but I've also tangled with crabs and I've gotten bitten. And so I was thinking, sweet, I have crab to bring home. But then I thought about those claws. But the thought of the sweet taste got the better of me. And I reached down and I grabbed the edges and I yanked it up in the air, and above me, water and sand came down, and there was a furious crab thrashing about, but it couldn't gain purchase on my flesh. And so I remember the feeling very primal as I walked home with my surfboard under one arm and the crab at the end of my other outstretched arm, and I had boiled crab for dinner.
What is more San Francisco, California than like a surfboard under one arm, dinner under the other? I mean, Greg, was it challenging or delightful to try to capture Eddie's words and what you saw at Ocean Beach in illustrations?
Oh yeah, it was delightful. I mean, I've spent a lot of time out there and observed the different creatures and plants, but to try to capture them to a standard, you know, was a good challenge. I hope that the naturalists out there, you know, don't find too many errors in my visual representation of what we put forward.
Well, they're really beautiful illustrations. Yeah, I want to ask the two of you, climate change has made it such that sometimes the fog isn't there for us and sometimes it really is there. And I can't think of Ocean Beach without thinking of like a pretty hefty marine layer. I mean, I don't think of Ocean Beach as a sunny beach. Tell me how you are kind of navigating a world where the fog that we grew up with is less prevalent. Eddie, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think Ocean Beach is really changing. I think it was sort of a dark, you know, foggy place, cold and nasty, you know, decades ago. And you always viewed the sand as dirty, but it's not really dirt. It's really magnetite crystals. And the fog is, quantitatively less. And so it is becoming a more user-friendly place. And more people are going there. And so it was sort of a forgotten part of the city. And I think that's very much changed. I think people are beginning to appreciate that the city is on the edge of this wildness and the cement ends, and you can walk out on sand and, you know, go up to your ankles in cold water and look west, and you could feel like you're some faraway place, not on the edge of this giant metropolis. So, mm-hmm. So I think it is changing.
What about you, Greg? I mean, how do you think about that beach as the climate changes?
Yeah, it is definitely changing. And I don't know. I mean, I think the beach has been resilient. It's adapted. So have the people who live there. And if it's a little sunnier, I don't know if anyone's going to complain who's at the beach or, you know, is close to it.
Eddie, I want to ask you, because you wrote this book about Ocean Beach, you live near Ocean Beach, but you have a full and very different career. I mean, an extraordinary one, helping sequence the human genome. And you led the Human Genome Project at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. How does your scientific background shape your view of Ocean Beach? I mean, are you always looking at it from that lens?
Well, I've been two things. I've been a scientist and a surfer. That's how I identify. And this book was quite fun because it allowed me to get deeper into some of the science, the creatures I was seeing.
Eddie, the book includes a dedication to people who are trying to keep the beach wild, and which I kind of love because, again, we talked about how this is a beach. It's on the edge of the continent, but it's also part of our city. Tell me about the ways in which you'd like to see all of us help keep the beach wild.
Yeah, it's 3.5 miles. So it's a big stretch of sand. And it has dunes and indigenous grasses and animals. And I think we can, you know, if we appreciate the beach, we can have it return to us a more primal state, its original state. And so I think there are ways to do that. I think it comes from having appreciation that this is a natural resource that we have at the city. And it's a special thing that we have. And I think in the past, people have thought less that way about Ocean Beach. It was sort of an afterthought. I think now people are viewing it as one of our treasures. And I think when we view it that way, we can begin to make choices that will enhance it in the future.
Greg, one last question to you. In illustrating this book, did you discover or learn anything about the beach that surprised you?
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. The thing that's coming to mind is the, not mystery, but I'd always been interested in why the sand is black in certain parts of the beach and why that kind of comes and goes over the course of a year, and to learn sort of the mineral history of where it comes from and how it is this magnetite. Is that right, Eddie?
Yeah.
Like that was a really just kind of like a thing that is underfoot, pervasive. The sand is really a huge part of the beach, and to learn a little bit more.
Eddie, what do you want people to take away from your book and to think about when they think about Ocean Beach?
Yeah, I mean, I think the book is, it's not an encyclopedic book. It doesn't have everything that's there. It has the common things. And I'm hoping that people will, begin to understand what they're seeing and appreciate the beach in a way with a little bit more knowledge. I want people to kind of have fun and get a little smarter and enjoy it.
Well, we've been talking to Eddie Rubin and Greg Wright. They're the authors of Ocean Beach, Fog, Fauna, and Flora. The book comes out on August 12th, and if you love Ocean Beach or want to see it through fresh eyes, the book is a must-have that you can pick up at any independent bookstore. Eddie and Greg, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. Next week, join us to get a back-to-school update for San Francisco and also hear about a new Mahjong speakeasy in Oakland. I definitely want to check that out. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, email us, stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Katie Colley. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Tariq Ansari was our board operator. Stay tuned to hear an episode of KALW's new podcast in residence, Not Born Yesterday. I'm Grace Wan. Good night. Thanks for listening.